Morning again, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Again, my name is Jennifer Oldvader. I'm representing Relator Church & Dwight. We're here today for two reasons, really. The first being that plaintiff Alicia Mulvey in the underlying circuit court case filed her Missouri Human Rights Act claims 91 days after the date of her notice of right to sue. But the Missouri Human Rights Act requires her to bring those claims within 90 days of the date of her notice, and specifically the statute reads, any action brought in court under this section shall be filed within 90 days from the date of the commission's notification letter to the individual. Plaintiff was also specifically advised of this 90-day deadline in her right to sue itself. In fact, she was advised twice of it, once in boldface capital type. Despite the fact that Plaintiff Mulvey did not meet her 90-day deadline, respondent refused to dismiss her Missouri Human Rights Act claims as untimely, necessitating Church & Dwight's petition for a writ of prohibition, which this court has preliminarily granted. Compounding this error, respondent also allowed Ms. Mulvey leave to amend her petition to add two common law claims of negligence and wrongful discharge. But these claims are merely a repackaging of her discrimination and retaliation claims under the Missouri Human Rights Act. And as this court has said, where a statutory scheme provides a comprehensive remedy and actually envelops the remedies of the common law, it supersedes and displaces the common law. And that's what happened here. But regardless, respondent allowed Ms. Mulvey to amend her petition to add these claims, which is clearly an attempt to do an end run around the 90-day limitations period of the Missouri Human Rights Act. Relator therefore petitioned this court for a writ of prohibition, directing respondent to vacate its denial of Church & Dwight's motion to dismiss on the timeliness issue of the Missouri Human Rights Act claims, and also vacating its grant of plaintiff's motion to amend to add the common law claims. Respondent now today asks this court to make this writ permanent to prevent the circuit court from proceeding on an action clearly barred by the statute of limitations and from preventing relator or from requiring relator to incur the expense of litigating the common law claims which are clearly superseded by the Missouri Human Rights Act itself. If we turn to the first of these issues, the 90-day limitations period, the crux of respondent's argument is that Ms. Mulvey had 93 days rather than 90 days to bring her MHRA claims. Specifically, respondent argues that the three-day mailing rule adopted by Civil Rule 44.01, subsection E, should apply to save Ms. Mulvey's claims, but it does not. First and foremost, the statute is clear. The Missouri Human Rights Act says the 90-day deadline runs from the date on the letter from the commission. It doesn't run from the date of service of the letter. It runs from the date on the letter. Not only is this clear from the plain language of the statute, it's also the position taken by the commission itself in the letter. In fact, again, it says it twice in the letter that Ms. Mulvey directs her that she had 90 days to file from the date of that letter. Not from the date she received it or the date it was served, but from the date on the letter itself. Rule 44.01E, therefore, is inapplicable because by its own terms, it only applies when a clock is triggered, when a limitations clock is triggered by service itself. But again, the statute doesn't mention service. It says 90 days from the date of the letter. Moreover, the Missouri legislature clearly gave Plaintiff Mulvey 90 days from the date of the letter, and Rule 44.01E should not be used to give plaintiff more time than the legislature gave her. Respondent spends a significant amount of time arguing that because Rule 44.01A has been applied to save MHRA claims as well as other claims arising from, for example, the Missouri Wrongful Death Act, that the entirety of the rule should apply to give plaintiff an additional 3 days. But respondent's argument misses the mark. First of all, subsection A of Rule 44 is drafted much more broadly than subsection E. Subsection A says it applies to the computation of any time period. Of course, we sort of refer to subsection A as the kind of holiday and weekend rule, saying that if a deadline falls on a holiday or weekend, you get to the following court day to file or respond or do whatever else is required of you. That is, again, much more broad language that appears in subsection E of that rule, which states that it only applies, giving people a kind of three-day mailing rule, when service by mail specifically is what triggers the deadline. But again, that's not what the Missouri Human Rights Act says. Second of all, respondent clearly speaks a lot about the Morris case decided by the Court of Appeals of the Eastern District, as well as this court's Bowling Green cases, but respondent misapprehends the rationale of those cases. In those cases, the deadline for the plaintiff to file under either the Wrongful Death Act in the Bowling Green case or under the MHRA in the Morris case fell on a weekend. And so what the Court of Appeals, as well as this court, said is, gosh, if we were not to give them another day, what we have effectively done is contract the statute of limitations period. If your 90 days falls on a Saturday, and this court decides that you have to file by Friday or your time is up, they've effectively given you 89 days. But that's not what's happened here. Ms. Mulvey's deadline fell on a Wednesday. If this court were to grant her an additional 3 days, it has effectively expanded the 90-day deadline and making it a 93-day deadline.
What if the order, and that's not this case, but what if the order were dated, say, January 1st, but for some reason didn't get mailed till February 1st or March 1st?
I think the 90-day deadline still applies. And then I think that the plaintiff is left to make, you know, equitable tolling arguments about extraordinary circumstances. But I think the statute is clear that the timeline is still going to run from that date of the letter itself.
And are there any prior cases addressing this going either way under this particular statute?
I don't, other than Hammond, which says that it will go, which rules, the ruling is the same as what we're asking for here, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
So the policy rationale that led this court to apply the sort of holiday weekend rule in Bowling Green, or led the Court of Appeals to apply in the Morris case, just simply doesn't apply here. We're not looking at for practical purposes, a reduction of the statute of limitations. We're looking at what plaintiff is asking for is an expansion of the statute of limitations.
Will we have to reverse or overrule any Court of Appeals cases if we rule as you are urging us to do?
No. The only case on this is the Hammond case. The Morris case applies only to 44.01A, and where, again, in that case, the deadline fell on a Saturday, I believe, so it did not apply to kind of a three-day mailing rule. The second issue that we're addressing today is the respondent's allowance of a plaintiff to amend her petition to add common law claims.
So now, do we even get to that issue if we resolve the first issue in your favor?
We do, because then the common law claims would still remain, because they have been granted. They're now on the docket in the court since he granted them leave to amend, and they did amend.
So we have to find that the common law claims are also subject to dismissal.
Yes. So the common law claims, again, are negligence and wrongful discharge. They're based on factual allegations that are identical to those that underlie the Missouri Human Rights Act claims. For instance, her plaintiff's negligence claim talks about the relators having a duty to supervise and train employees in order to prevent discrimination or retaliation, that respondents or relators, breached this duty, and as a result, plaintiff Mulvey was discriminated and retaliated against.
The Human Rights Act claims are intentional torts, is that right? So these are negligence actions.
They are, yes. Similarly, for her wrongful discharge claim, plaintiff essentially claims that she reported her legal harassment in what she terms as assault and then was fired. But again, these are the same allegations she makes in her Missouri Human Rights Act retaliation claim. This court has held that where a statutory scheme such as the Missouri Human Rights Act fully comprehends and envelops the remedies provided by common law, it displaces common law. And here there is no doubt that the Missouri Human Rights Act provides plaintiff with a complete remedy. It provides everything plaintiff could hope to attain with a common law theory, including lost wages, compensatory damages, and punitives. And it actually is even broader than the remedies allowed at common law, because it allows for the recovery of attorney's fees. And also, you know, as I was thinking about, while the Missouri Human Rights Act certainly is thought of to be as an intentional tort, going back to Judge Stiff's question, you know, there are certain cases that allow employers to be held liable when they sort of should have known if their supervisors were, especially if it's something engaged in by a supervisor. Okay. So I think in that way, while it technically is an intentional, I think, tort, there is sort of, depending on who's sort of committing the bad acts, there could be liability for the employer, just on a kind of should have known basis. Your Honors, relators would ask this court again to make the preliminary writ permanent. Plaintiff Mulvey simply filed her Missouri Human Rights Act claims outside of the limitations period set by the Act. They should have been dismissed. She cannot remedy this by morphing her claims or kind of recasting them as common law claims to avoid the 90-day deadline. Therefore, we ask, you know, that this court make its writ permanent so that relator doesn't have to bear the burden of litigating untimely claims or the expense of litigating facially deficient claims. Thank you.
Any questions? Thank you. We'll hear from you in rebuttal.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. If the writ is made permanent, the respondent believes it would ignore the Supreme Court's holding in Bowling, which was a wrongful death action, a different statutory cause of action, but albeit another cause of action, where this court found 4401 applied to the filing and the period in which a cause of action must be filed. It would also be finding, I think more importantly, and which wasn't addressed initially, was that the Missouri Rules of Civil Procedure as a whole, which are promulgated by this court under Article 5, Section 5 of the Missouri Constitution, don't apply to a cause of action that's pending in circuit court. In this case, it's a cause of action pending in Cass County.
They do or don't apply?
Well, if the court were to make the writ permanent, it would find that the Missouri rules don't apply. And the reason for that, and I'll expand on that rather than talk about it later, is those rules are promulgated, obviously, under the Missouri Constitution, Article 5. If they are inconsistent with the statute, the procedural rules govern. The procedural rule in this case, and there's a couple of them, 4102 is the procedural rule that says if there is an inconsistency, and the inconsistency in the statute with the MHRA under 213.111 is what I will contend is some vague language, but the last sentence, which is what the relators in this case urge the court to follow, which is the cause of action, the petition, should be filed within 90 days of the date of the notification letter, the right to sue letter.
And how is that inconsistent with the rule?
It's inconsistent with Rule 4401E. Rule 4401E is straight out of Rule 6 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure. If this were a Title VII cause of action in federal court under identical facts, Rule 6 would give Ms. Mulvey 3 days mailing.
The general principle is that substantive law may be the same in the federal and in the state, but procedures can vary between the federal and the state. Why is this not a procedural variance?
Well, the statute of limitations as a whole, I think, is a procedural issue for this court to discern. And I think the procedure, the mechanism of filing suit in this case, and the procedure that's given to a plaintiff, in this case, to file a cause of action, is under the Rules of Civil Procedure, and specifically, Rule 4401E.
Right, and why can't that vary from the time period allowed by the federal system?
I think that this forum is allowed its own procedures. I don't dispute that.
So we don't have to give the additional 3 days?
I think under this court's inherent authority to promulgate its own Rules of Civil Procedure, you have that authority. But when you look at those rules, and you look at it in comparison to the statute that's at issue, there is a contrast. And
Counsel, subsection E says, when a party has their riders required to do an act within a prescribed period after the service of a notice or other paper, 3 days shall be added. So that begs the question, doesn't it, whether some statute or something else says you have to do the act within 3 days after the service of the notice. And this doesn't really answer the question, does it? It just restates the question that if something else requires something to be done after service, we add 3 days. But that gets us back to the original question. Doesn't the MHRA say you do something after the notice is sent and not after service? It doesn't mention.
Well, it actually says three things.
Okay.
The first two sentences of 213.111 talk about a letter. Then they talk about a notice. And to be candid with the court, the last sentence does say 90 days within the date of the notification letter. If the court believes that that's clear and annuls Rule 4401E.
But nothing, and that's my point, is why are you saying it annuls it? It just says if something makes it from the date of service, we add 3 days. It doesn't say everything is from the date of service. That's how you're interpreting it.
Right, and the triggering, and the way that I interpret the triggering is it's called a right to suit notice. I mean, when you actually look at the mechanism that begins the process toward filing a petition for damages under the MHRA, it's a right to sue notice. that word notice in and of itself, I believe, falls under 4401E, which is the notice that then triggers your obligation and the mechanism to bring an action in court, in this case, a petition for damages. That's where the 3 days mailing comes in. That's the Bowling case when they applied 4401A, and I guess, I'm confused, and I tried to point this out in my brief, how this court could find that one subsection of 4401A applies to the filing of a cause of action, but not a subsequent subsection. In this case, if this were on a holiday or a weekend, the court would say 4401A applies.
Well, isn't the application of each subsection is based on the language of the subsection? So if they have different language as to their application, they have different application.
Absolutely. And the language, as Ms. Oldaver pointed out under 4401E, is whenever there is something that is triggered by notice of service by mail, which is what exists in this case.
Well, and it's not that. It says when a party has the right or is required to do some act or take some proceedings within a prescribed period after the service of a notice or other paper. So that begs the question, were they required to do something after the service of a notice? And you haven't read me anything in the MHRA that says service of the notice is the trigger.
Right. The language of the statute under 213.111, I contend, doesn't entirely clear this up, but this is the operative language. And this is what was pointed out in the Hammond case. And by the way, the Western District Court of Appeals, which was the author of that opinion, even pointed out that they wish that this system would mirror Rule 6 to alleviate any ambiguity or any confusion. Having said that, they said the statute's a statute. And more importantly, in Hammond, they said the reason that 4401E doesn't apply is because it's an administrative action. It is not an administrative
action.
Didn't
they give two reasons, and the second one was the administrative, because it was an administrative matter, and that part has been criticized, but their first basis for their decision, that criticism doesn't apply.
Yeah, initially they looked at the language of the statute and they admitted that there was confusion with the first two sentences, with the use of the phrases letter and notice. Notice being synonymous with receipt, and which would invoke or implicate the 3 days mailing under the rules of civil procedure.
Did they go on to find that the third sentence made it perfectly clear that it was from the date of the letter, not from the date of service?
That's correct, Your Honor. The third sentence, or the last sentence that's at issue in that statute, is what the Court of Appeals indicated made it clear. I think it's just a third undefined term that is found in that statute that doesn't make it clear. But
right.
I think more importantly,
it is the last sentence, not the third sentence.
Right. It's the third use, I guess. It's the last sentence of the statute. And as I contended before, I think all it does is it puts the language of the statute, whether you look at the first use letter, the second use notice, or the third notification letter, those are the three phrases at issue. I think it clearly puts it at issue with Rule 4401E, and the procedural rule should govern. It is a procedural issue, the statute of limitations.
Is there anything that is misleading to the plaintiff on the notice she received? Because the notice tells her she has the 90-day deadline.
Right.
Is that language pretty clear?
The language in the Notice of Right to Sue letter, which is in the appendix that's furnished to the court, says in clear language, well, I'll contend it's not clear under 4401, but there's language in there that mirrors to some degree what you see in the statute. Anecdotally, and I think the reason 4401E does apply is uniformity. It's the same reason the Bowling Court, this court, in the 1970s, issued the opinion on the Wrongful Death Act, which was we want to promote uniformity within our procedures in filing suit. You assume that Jefferson City mails a letter the same day they close the file and administrator closes the matter. That's not always the case. That letter could get to Cole County quicker than Atchison County or quicker than Adair County. And so the 3 days mailing and the rationale and the policy found behind Rule 4401E is to promote that uniformity, is to promote that equity, and more importantly, is to promote the reasoning behind the MHRA as it now stands, which is a liberal construction and favors cases to be disposed of on the merits. If the court were to believe that the language in 213.111 is clear, it would be more restrictive than Title VII. And I know that those statutes are not the same. This court, in many cases, has said it has remedies not found in Title VII. This court has also said it can be restrictive in other ways. But on this point alone, it would be more restrictive than Rule 6, which does give that claimant or that plaintiff or that charging party that 3 days mailing.
Would you address the hypothetical that Judge Stith raised, that if the letter is dated January 1st, but it is not sent out until January 31st, what is the effect under the interpretation urged by relator?
It limits the 90 days. It just would, because if the court were to adopt a hard and fast, clear standard that 213.111 is clear, it annuls the Missouri Rules of Civil Procedure, and it should be given effect over those rules, then you have a hard and fast 90 days, regardless of when the letter is sent and regardless of when it is received.
You argue that equitable tolling would be available if we don't rule for you on your first on the first grant.
Right.
But it is suggested that equitable tolling is available only if the statute authorizes it. If there is a statute that says there can be equitable tolling. So under the hypothetical from Judge Stith, right. if there's not a statute that says a delay in mailing it permits equitable tolling, then that would not be available.
I think the equitable tolling that I urged on the court in the brief had to do more with the process. And I've practiced in the area of employment discrimination, and I know once you get the right to sue letter, your next step is to ask for the file. The Missouri Commission on Human Rights cannot release the file until a right to sue letter is issued and the file is closed. In that file, there are interrogatories, and the interrogatories ask the respondent, or respondents in this case, for their name and contact information. This petition, if the court believes, was filed untimely, was filed 103 minutes late. I'm the one that filed it. I electronically filed it. That 103 minutes, I believe, is tolled to the extent tolling does apply by virtue of the fact that those interrogatories were not answered. I get a file from the Missouri Commission on Human Rights in that 90-day time window, and I do not have any information with which to name or serve the individual defendants in this case. I can always find a registered agent through the Missouri Secretary of State. It gets much harder in the way the Missouri Human Rights Act is now. There is individual liability. That could change. But for the time being, they're individuals, and I did not have that information in the interrogatories to propel the case forward. And so that did delay things. I was not furnished that information. I elected to attempt to serve individuals at work. There were two individuals in this case that were never served. And so if equitable tolling does apply, then I think it tolls certainly 103 minutes given the facts. Switching gears real quickly to the common law claims. I've asserted those before this case, and I've asserted them after. As to the negligence claims, it isn't that they negligently violated the Missouri Human Rights Act. That's not the claim. Those claims are a little more collateral. It is that there has been a negligent supervision or some negligent retention of the actors involved in this set of facts.
And they argue that that's encompassed in, since this was an employment situation, in the Workers' Comp Act, and intentional torts are under the MHRA, and there's not room for additional common law causes.
Absolutely. The Dierkes case, I think, if it says it fully envelops, I think mm-hmm. is the language that the court has used in past opinions, if it fully envelops those remedies, and my belief is that it doesn't. I think there are separate remedies and separate mechanisms found in the negligence cause of action, as well as the wrongful discharge. The wrongful discharge in this case, so the court understands factually, is the harassing words and conduct of the perpetrator in this case.
But that isn't an action you can bring under the MHRA.
It's
wrongful
a separate
discharge.
Cause of action.
But I mean, you can bring that if we were to allow a supplemental common law cause of action. What do you say to opposing counsel's argument that that would negate the intended effect of requiring the matter to first be filed with the administrative agency within a certain period of time, and then giving a much more than usual, usually a 2-year statute of limitations instead of a longer one that normally
right.
might apply. Everybody just file outside it, and it would defeat the purpose of the legislature in enacting that, unless there's something that's not actionable under the statute or another statute.
Certainly, and I think
that a problem?
It's probably the whistleblowing refusal to violate the law, the whistleblowing in this case being the criminal statutes, which are the harassment and assault, which the Akers case that I cite in the brief is upheld. It's a federal case, but there just aren't that many cases on this point. The harassing conduct in this case is the words and conduct of the perpetrator toward the victim. My time's out. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honors, I wanted to address two things I think that were raised, and obviously answer any questions. The first is the analogy that the respondent continues to make to the Title VII statute. That is a different statute. And the federal courts are not applying Rule 6 to extend the deadline for bringing a Title VII action. Instead, they're interpreting the statute to be a receipt-based statute. The statute of Title VII says that the 90-day deadline runs from the giving of notice, which the federal courts have said that means receipt. And they have then applied a 3-day mailing presumption. They have not applied Rule 6 as a whole. They've just applied this mailing presumption to when individuals get the letter, a presumption that could be overcome. But that's not what this statute says. It's not a receipt-based statute. It's a date of the notification letter statute. The other thing, too, on the equitable tolling argument, this court has held, obviously, that a statute of limitations may generally just be suspended or tolled by specific disabilities or exceptions enacted by the legislature, but it has held that plaintiff, you know, because if there was some reason they were prevented from timely filing by defendant's action or other pending litigation or extraordinary circumstances, there could be equitable tolling. And I think that does, again, answer Judge Sis's question, that if there is some remarkable delay in receiving the notice, I think those are the sort of extraordinary circumstances that could apply. I don't believe that what plaintiff Mulvey, or respondent, is arguing on behalf of plaintiff Mulvey qualifies as extraordinary circumstances. First of all, you do not need individuals' addresses to file a petition. He filed them on day 91 with their business addresses. He could have done that on day 90, nor does he explain why 90 days wasn't sufficient to find these individuals. He certainly had their names. Ms. Mulvey had them at the time she filed her charge in November of the prior year. And also, you know, while he wants to lay this at the feet of the defendant, as an initial matter, I note that my client, Relator Church and Dwight, was not the employer of any of these individuals and therefore could not have given their addresses. And also that neither Church and Dwight nor Relator Focus in the companion case were under any sort of legal compulsion to answer those. That is a voluntary process with the Missouri Human Rights Commission unless they issue some sort of administrative subpoena, which did not happen here. We're not under any obligation. We submit a position statement. We generally, you know, as employers, and certainly my client, does our best to cooperate. But, you know, unless the Missouri Commission follows up with a subpoena, we're not under compulsion to provide that information. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted.